Brother, listen to older people. Sometimes when they tell you stuff, it might seem like, oh man, they just old-fashioned. But you know what? It take a lot of sense. I mean, it take a lot of sense to live to be 40, 50, 60 years old. Fools don't really make it that long.
Boise Voices is an intergenerational oral history project founded by Apricot Irving. This project pairs at-risk youth with elderly, longtime residents in the Boise Iliad neighborhood. The culmination of this project is a Boise Voices website, which will allow visitors to access historical information about the Boise neighborhood, as well as listen to excerpts of recorded interviews. A Boise Voices audio CD will feature additional material from the interview. Tonight on Circle A Radio, we talk with founder Apricot Irving and listen to elders talk about the Boise neighborhood. Stay tuned.
My name's Apricot Anderson Irving, and I live on Gantenbein in the Boise neighborhood. I just think I've always loved stories. I grew up in a family where we had lots of people coming through. We lived in lots of different places. There's always people over for dinner, and my parents, both of them, are just really good at drawing people out. And so I think ever since I was a kid, just having this appreciation for the stories that are to be found, neighbors, people, random people on a bus or walking down the sidewalk. And Americans love to tell their stories. Americans are so much more open than the Brits that we'd been living among. It was great.
How did the Boise Voices project start?
When we first moved to the neighborhood, part of the reasons that drew us to it were the stories, just the sense of the different kinds of people that lived there, the little bit that I knew of its history and how interesting that history was. And so when we moved back, I knew that I wanted somehow to hear people's stories. I started going to the Neighborhood Association meetings, and Linda Hunter from Our United Villages came in and talked about an elder storytelling event that they'd done back, I think it was in 2003. I loved the idea, and so I just asked her if those had ever been recorded, and they hadn't. And even in those few years, some of the people had developed Alzheimer's, a few had died. So it was a sense that the stories that there were to be heard were disappearing, and there was a grant that was coming up due in a couple weeks, and so someone from the Neighborhood Association said, oh, we should write a grant and see if we can get it for the neighborhood. And so I did, and we did get it. We wanted to connect not just the elders and the people that would hear their stories, but the young people from the community and gathering those stories. And so I talked with Julie Keefe, who's been in the neighborhood a long time and has done really great projects there, her Hello Neighbor project with the beautiful banners. And she suggested talking to the schools. And so Molly Chun at Boise Iliad Elementary was wonderful and got connected with some third graders there and their teachers. And then Rance Spruill at AYOS, Albina Youth Opportunity School in Mississippi, was also really helpful. And so I made a pitch to some of the kids there, and a handful of them said that they were interested. And so there was a group of third graders and then a group of high schoolers.
And who were the elders?
That was the fun part. As soon as started floating the idea, anyone that I talked to from the Neighborhood Association, just who worked or lived in the area, started coming up with, oh, you've got to talk to this person, you've got to talk to this person. And so I just started a list of everyone that anyone would tell me we needed to talk to. Kay Newell was just fantastic at the Sunland Lightbulb Store. Every time I'd go in and talk with her, she'd hand me a list of people that had walked through her door, and if they qualified, then she'd have them write down their name and number, and I would contact them. And so we found some really great people through Kay, especially. John Helmer, he was one of the people that just came into Sunland with his wife, Beverly, and wrote his name down. And when I contacted him, he was really great, really enthusiastic about the project. He graduated from Boise Iliad Elementary School. It was then called Boys, back in the 1930s, and then went on to fly planes in World War II, and owned a menswear store still there in downtown Portland, biked through Europe in the 1950s with his wife, just has some amazing stories.
My full name is John Helmer, Jr., and my father's name was John Helmer, and our son's name is John Helmer III, and I was born on August 24th, 1923, in Portland, Oregon, and I lived most of my life on Beach in Vancouver on the corner, one block from the Wonder Bakery.
What businesses do you remember in this neighborhood when you were growing up?
We had three grocery stores within one block away from our house on Beach Street. And we had a shoe repair shop, and we had one ice cream parlor, you know, where they served ice cream.
Did you ever go to the ice cream store with any of your friends?
Oh, yes. And I can remember my mother used to send me with an empty pitcher, you know, that you carry water in. And we would buy ice cream, and I'd carry it home. I used to go to Phipps Drugstore, which was on Mississippi and Shaver on the corner. And a Coca-Cola cost 5 cents. And a dish of ice cream cost about 10 cents. And a milkshake cost about 15 cents. And we used to buy from a meat market on Fremont Street, Fremont and Williams. And in those days, the butchers that were cutting meat, they wore all white long aprons. They always wore a hat because they were inside and outside the refrigerator, big walk-in refrigerators. And there was sawdust on the floor. And we used to charge and then pay for the food at the end of the month. And my mother would give me the money to go pay the butcher. And whenever I paid the bill, he would give me a box of animal crackers. So I was always happy to pay the bill.
How is the world different from now and when you were a child?
Oh, yes, quite different. I think so many more automobiles. We played in the street a lot, played football in the street, baseball. Kirby Street was our roller skating street. It's a very smooth street, and we used to play roller hockey, and adults would use it for roller skating, and there'd be hundreds of children roller skating on Kirby Street. On the corner of Beach and Haight, we would play softball, and then we played games called Annie Annie Eye Over and Kick the Can and games like that. Have you heard of games like that?
Yes, I have. What were your goals and ambitions when you were young? Which ones have you been able to fulfill?
Oh, yes. I love to climb mountains, so I climbed 50 different peaks in Oregon, Washington, and California. Beverly and I climbed Mount Hood together when we were first married. I used to say that if you can see Mount Hood there every morning, you have to climb it in your lifetime.
Sherry Dodge, I actually met at the library downtown. I was checking out books with my three-year-old, and she looked at my library card and she said, "I knew the woman who lived at your house." Turns out it was her best friend when she was growing up. And so she came in as well to the school and talked to the third graders. She had gone to kindergarten at the school there and had lots of memories of the neighborhood. And that was so fun, just small town Portland.
My name is Cheryl Ann Dodge. My maiden name was Warmoth. There were a lot of Germans and Polish and Finnish that lived in this area. I was born here in Portland at Portland Sanitarium Hospital, which is no longer existing. That was 1944. That was during the World War II years.
How old were you when you moved to the Boise neighborhood?
I was 2.5 years old when I moved here.
Where was your childhood home located? Did you enjoy living there?
Yes, I lived on the corner of Failing in Vancouver until I was a teenager. And I did love living there because it was a great neighborhood and my best friend was there, who is still my best friend after all these years.
How is the world different now from when you were a child?
Well, I was born in the war years. the war years were kind of tough on families. I had to give up a lot, but they did what they had to do to get through things. And my uncles were also living with my grandma during the war, and my mother also, because my dad was at sea. So I was thoroughly spoiled by the time my father got back from the Navy. And probably after the war was some of the best times, because the men came home and married and raised families.
What businesses do you remember in this neighborhood when you were growing up?
We did not have a park down this street. I'm not sure what the name of it is. I think there used to be a grocery store there where I used to go and buy groceries. My mother would send me with a list and a little bit of money. And the grocer knew everybody. So if he wasn't sure about something, he'd call your house and ask your mother for sure, is that what she wanted, or would you like this better or that better? And then they would get the order right, and then we'd walk home with the with our groceries for our mother. On Mississippi, we used to have the Rio Theater, and those have been torn down. That's where they were. I think that's right next to Pistols. And Phipps Pharmacy used to be where that coffee shop now is. That used to be our place to go get Katie Keene comic books, which are no longer in existence, but they were a lot of fun, because you used to be able to design clothes for Katie. We had a haberdashery. That's a hat shop. It was down about one more block on Mississippi, and the lady used to have all kinds of beautiful hats in the windows on both sides. The Hilltop Tavern was right on the corner of Mississippi and Fremont. I believe there's a furniture manufacturer there now. But in those days, families could go. I used to go there with my dad and my uncle and my mom. There was a Wonder Bread bakery down here. It took up a whole block, and right now there's an empty block sitting there. Kitty corner from that was a gas station. And across the street, where there used to be a tire company, there was a drugstore there. And like I say, a lot has changed in here. We had a nursery over on Williams Avenue. It was grew camellia bushes, and I can't remember the name of that. We had an ice cream store that I'm sure was probably built before 1900. We used to get our ice cream, and we used to buy wax lips and stuff like that, and mustaches and whatnot we play with, and cigarettes, as I remember. I can remember Kitty Corner from us on Vancouver Avenue was a Champion gas station, and they had a big ice house, because a lot of the people in the neighborhood did not have refrigerators. They had ice boxes. So they would go over and get their big chunk of ice once a week, and or once every few days, and keep their food cold that way. We did have a tinker. He was a man who would go around, and this one would sell you pots or pans. He would sharpen your knives and your scissors, and he drove a horse. We didn't see too many horse-driven vehicles in the neighborhood in those days, but occasionally we would see one. But a lot of businesses have gone away. You've got new ones coming in. So things have changed a whole lot since my grandparents were also in this neighborhood, both sets.
What were some of your experiences during the Civil Rights Movement?
I think many of us didn't quite understand everything that was going on. I think a lot more of it was more evident in the South. I didn't really find out how much prejudice there was until I became an adult here and realized that we had groups called the Ku Klux Klan here who were against black people, Catholics, and various other things that they didn't like. But somehow we seemed to be mostly sheltered from that sort of thing. And as children, we didn't realize there was such a thing as prejudice. We just made friends with everybody, and we didn't think about things like that. My parents never understood what all the anger was about. I think maybe they do now, but they at that time they didn't understand what all the problems were.
That was Cheryl Dodge here on Circle A Radio. She is one of the elders participating in the Boise Voices Project. This is founder and producer Apricot Irving.
Louise read an article about us in the Portland Sentinel back in March when we were just kind of getting off the ground and called me up. It's great. She's become a really close friend. She's such a natural storyteller. She's so dynamic, and she has some pretty amazing stories to tell.
I'm an Okie from Muskogee. My name is Myrtle Louise Grogan, and my maiden name is Taylor. I was born on December the 30th, 1936. When I came to Portland in 1941, I was 5 years old when my mother and father came to Portland, and they started working at the shipyard.
How is the world different now from when you were a child?
Oh, sweetheart, it is so much different now than when I was a child. We had a theater over on, used to be Union Avenue, and now it's Martin Luther King. And the name of it was The Egyptian. And guess what? Since I was a Negro, or a little colored girl, we could go to that theater, but we could not sit downstairs. We had to sit upstairs. And if we tried to sit downstairs, we'd be told, "Ho, where do you think you're going?" So that has changed, because now we have rights. When I was young, I didn't have any ambitions, because I didn't really know what ambitions were. I could easily say I wanted to be able to run faster, so maybe I wanted to be a track star, you know? But I never had an ambition to be a doctor or a teacher. But an ambition, something you strive to be and you want to excel at it. And I didn't have any ambitions. I was just a little old colored girl, and my ambitions was just to grow up. That's all we had to look forward to. When we looked at TV, we didn't see anything on TV that we could say, I'd like to do that. It was nothing but white faces. We weren't anywhere. I can remember when I was going to Jefferson, they have career day at the high schools. And I can remember when I was a freshman, my girlfriend and I, we went to the class where they had flight attendants. It was the airlines there. And at that time, it was in 1952, they could actually tell us, "Oh, forget it. We don't hire Negroes." That hurt me. So the first chance I got to start working for an airline, I finally got a job in 1974, United Airlines. And I traveled, you name it. I traveled anywhere there was to go. And we were so welcomed every place. And it seemed so awful to come back to the United States where I was born and I wasn't welcome. Say we were in Tokyo, we'd be taking pictures. All those people loved us. In Italy, they loved us, you know? And in the hot spots like the Caribbeans, well, the men loved us, you know. But anyway, it was really interesting to say you can go all over the world and be treated as an equal when you come back to the United States and you're treated as a second-class citizen. I have so many magazines from back in the 60s and the 50s, and everything there is a Negro this and a Negro that. the first Negro to do this and the first Negro to do that. And now, guess what? In 2009, we had the first African-American that became president of the United States. I mean, I didn't think I'd ever see that day, you know? And so I think me being an African-American, what has changed is that people have realized that when I bleed, it's red just like yours. And when I love, it's the same kind of love. And that God, He loves us all. You understand? We're all one.
Describe your mother in her best dress.
Oh, God, my mother was elegant. She belonged to a Rose Social Club here. They had an Oklahoma Social Club and, oh, the Modern Matrons and Urban League Gill. And she would just look elegant. And most of the times, her dress would come up like wings. It'd be white and flowing with some sequins on it. Anyway, she'd be dressed to the nines. And guess what? She loved her furs. That's when furs were really in.
Did she ever go dancing?
Oh, my mother and father, they went dancing all the time. Because all the social clubs they had here in Portland, this is in the 50s and the 60s now. We're in the 50s and 60s. That was the only thing for you to do. It was a formal affair, and on the invitations it always said black tie or after five. What you did mostly was dance. Ballroom dancing and slow dancing and swing dancing. Now, I can remember in the 60s, we used to do the twists. I was a twist champion. But you asked about my parents. There was Paul's Paradise, the Cotton Club. There was the Oklahoma Club, Esquire Club. These are all, I don't know if they were black owned, but most of the clientele was black. And then they used to say colored or Negro. No, that's not a bad name. I grew up a little colored girl. It's nothing to be ashamed of, okay? When I was born in 1936, I was a little colored girl, and I was a Negro. Because it wasn't until, I think it was the 70s, when everybody started saying black and African American. But when I grew up, I was just a little colored girl, and I was proud of it.
How has this neighborhood changed over time?
All the stores and everything, that's an improvement. Mississippi Avenue, they had lots of stores there and everything, but it wasn't as plush or it wasn't as developed. And when I went to school here, there really weren't too many Negroes going here. It was mostly, you'd say, European Americans.
What brought about these changes?
People. They build things, they tore things down. They came here from various different parts of the country, actually from different parts of the world. So it brought about a change. That's what change is good, though. You realize that. That's what it's all about, change.
Paul Knowles, we discovered through some friends, Judith Yelvington and Dave Edwards, they were putting together a show at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center on dance halls of Portland. And so they were featuring different dance halls around the city, one of which was Paul Knowles' Cotton Club. And we actually did the interview there at the IFCC, which was great. They were really helpful. Paul Knowles is also a really beloved figure in Portland, not just for the Cotton Club or Geneva's hair salon, which he and his wife still run, but just, you know, he's kind of unofficially the mayor of Northeast Portland, has all these great stories about the community. And so people I've talked to since have said, wow, you got him to do the program with you. That's so great.
My name is Paul Knowles. I was born in Huntington, Arkansas, 1931. That means I'm 78 years old.
Wow. So me and you both know Portland's a great place, but what brought you here?
My family is very religious, and I wanted to buy a nightclub, so I wanted to live in Seattle. But they had all moved to Seattle, and so I knew how they would feel about me selling alcohol because they were so religious. So I decided that, well, maybe I'll go to Portland. I need a place where there's a nice African-American community. So that's when I came to Portland and opened a nightclub, 1963.
And the nightclub was called the Cotton Club, right?
Yes, nightclub was called the Cotton Club. I bought it from Mr. T. Mr. Thompson, they always called him Mr. T.
Can you describe what the Cotton Club was like?
Well, the Cotton Club, our slogan was, it was the only nightclub on the West Coast with wall-to-wall soul. So that gives you an idea of the kind of spot that we had. We had music, had a jam session on Sunday that all the musicians would come in and set in. And then at night we would feature the floor shows. And we brought some famous people through, you won't remember these names, but Big Mama Thornton, she did the song Hound Dog before Elvis Presley, and then that company stole it from her. Little Esther Phillips, she was a singer and she could sing those blues. It was just the spot. On any given night, you might look up and, like one night, my wife went to a concert for Sammy Davis Jr. Then Sammy showed up and he got up and sang a song with my little three-piece band, and we closed at 2:30, but Sammy was there until about 4 that morning. Then one night, after the Mamas and Papas finished their concert, I looked up and here was Mama Cass. To see people come in your spot like that, that means they've heard about it and they just wanted to hit it to see what it was like. Joe Louis came in one night, you know, the Brown Bomber. And so when people like that visit your spot, it makes it very, very famous.
What was the neighborhoods like in the 1960s and 70s?
Okay, the neighborhoods were, African Americans lived no further north than Fremont, and no farther east than about 22nd or 23rd. I remember a lady that, a friend of ours, bought a house on 21st and Thompson, and someone set a cross on her lawn and burned it to let her know that she wasn't welcome in the neighborhood, you know. And this was 1963, 64. And most of the African Americans lived around Emmanuel Hospital in that area. But then as times changed and Emmanuel tore down the business on Williams and Russell, then of course they had to have a place to move. So people started moving all over, even further north.
Why did the Cotton Club close its doors?
Oh, that's a real tragic story. In 1968, when Doc Seawy, I had a crowd. I had the white people came like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And then on weekends, the club would turn to African-Americans come out. They didn't come out every night then. So I had the best of both worlds. Around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I got all the car dealers, all the car salesmen. They would come after they get off work. And then the night people would come. And then there was a news reporter with the Oregon Journal. His name was Doug Baker. And he liked our show. So Doug would come to see the show. And the next day, he would write down an article about the show he saw at the Cotton Club last night, and all these white people show up, you know. Whoa, that's great, you know, because the money's coming in. Then on weekends, you know, the African Americans came out, so I had the best of both worlds. But then when Dr. King got killed, that started to separate the races. So the whites stopped coming because the blacks were there, and the blacks stopped coming because the whites were there. So here I am sitting there with this business, and I have no business, you know. I mean, it just separated the races just like that. I mean, overnight. And that's why the Cotton Club went down.
What was the most stressful experience that you ever lived through?
I think it was the Dr. King assassination. That was hard. Well, I had three businesses going then, and I had to close them all, you know, because they didn't want people drinking and going out doing things that they would regret later. So I did actually close my businesses there for about 4 days when the heat was off. I think that was the worst time.
What helped you get through it?
probably just adjusting to things. You know, I would go out at night and try to make sure that if I saw anyone on the streets that was planning on doing anything, that talk them down. You know, you don't want to go to jail for the next 20, 25 years.
You are listening to Circle A Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. Tonight, we are profiling the oral history project, Boise Voices, which pairs at-risk youth from Albina Youth Opportunity School and Boise Elementary School with Boise neighborhood elders in order to preserve the history of the neighborhood. Again, this is Apricot Irving.
John and Vivian Parker, they've lived in the neighborhood for 50 years. They were one of the people that anyone I spoke to said, oh, you've got to talk to the Parkers. And actually, there's a really beautiful banner of Julie Keefe's. It's still on Michigan and Shaver, I believe. You can see a picture of both of them. They were really lovely. It was fun. It was the only interview we did where we had two people at once sitting down with one of the kids to interview.
My name is John Henry Parker, Jr. I was born in 1933 in Arrow Rock, Missouri.
I'm Vivian Parker. I was born in 1940 in El Dorado, Arkansas. I left Arkansas when I was about 4 years old because my parents moved here during the wartime in the 40s, and they got work in the shipyards. I've been to the place where I was born once, and that was as an adult. When my dad was in the South, you know, back in the 40s, things were not real good in the South for black people, and he had a very hot temper, and he said that when he left, because of his experiences there, he was either going to get killed or kill somebody. So he left, and he said, I'll never go back. He didn't go back, and he didn't take us back. And so that's how I happened to not know my grandparents or anything like that. So it was based upon his experiences that he had in the South.
Was Portland, like, much different from when it is now? I'm sure it was, but, like, what were some specific things you can remember?
That's different?
Yeah, like, you personally.
Yes. There's some good differences. When I first came to Portland as a child, we lived in Vanport, which was a segregated area. It was a place where there were poor people, whites and blacks, living in that area, but the blacks lived together pretty much, and the whites lived together, but we were all poor. Right, there was a flood in Vanport, that's why we had to move from there.
In 1948, guess what happened? Vanport flooded. Have you ever heard of a place called Vanport? It was a housing project that was put up for mainly people that worked in the shipyard in low-income housing. And then it flooded. The dike broke. And it was like with not too much warning, because they'd said everything will be okay, and then it wasn't. But guess what? We didn't live in Vanport. A lot of people did. And then guess what? We didn't have gym for several days. And the reason why was because they were housing a lot of the people from the Vanport flood in our gymnasium. They had them sleeping on cots, and I guess probably, I can't remember, but I know we didn't have gym for days. And they were asking the families around here who could take some people in. Red Cross was helping, but it was really devastating because so many people had lost so many things.
One of the things that I think is memorable to me, because growing up, because of being in the flood and being moved to, you know, living with somebody, living in a school, living on Swan Island, and just moved back and forth during my early elementary school years, just jumping forward to when my husband and I was married young, I married at 18, almost 19, and we went to buy a home And buying a home back in the 50s here in Portland, it was very racist because we were not shown a home past 7th Avenue, if you could believe it, back in the 50s. You couldn't get a loan to purchase a home. And so it was very restricted where you could look for a home. Money was not available to purchase a home. And so some of those things have changed, you know, and those are good changes for me. And so, you know, some of my memories.
Yeah, we purchased a home in North Michigan back in 59. And when we moved into the block there were about 15 houses on the block there. We were the second black family that moved there.
We heard that there was, you were redlined, you know, there was areas that you couldn't go past that. They wouldn't show you the house. Then if you couldn't, you know, even if you saw it, you couldn't purchase it because no bank would loan you the money if you were going to buy a home past that area that they'd blocked out. So what happened was in the 50s, 60s, probably 70s, there was a lot of white flight because when one black person moved into a neighborhood, then everybody on that street just kind of like flew to the suburbs.
Around back in 66 when things began to kind of break like that.
Yeah, we lived through that. Mm-hmm. We've lived on the block there for 50 years, just about. The original house we bought for $5,000.
We've been in the neighborhood since 1959, so we're 50 years in the neighborhood.
Almost. Yeah, 50 years.
50 years,
oh my
yeah.
gosh, yeah.
How long have you guys known each other?
51 years.
About 51 or 52 years. I married after a year or so after I met her.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Things worked out well.
Yeah. Doesn't mean it's been perfect, but it's been good. It's real. It's been real.
How'd you guys meet?
We met about a block, two blocks from here. They used to be on the corner of Beach and Borthwick. It was a church there. It was a Beach Street Church. And so we met there in the Sunday school class.
Yeah, he was teaching my Sunday school class.
She was supposed to be the teacher. She was late.
No, my teacher was late. Were teaching.
And I came. I was a visitor, so they let me teach. I was from Nebraska, so.
Anyway, the church is the church never rebuilt. It burnt. There was a fire there, and it's still a vacant lot. It's
yeah, right on the corner of Beach and Barthwood.
Right there. Street.
Yeah, 625 Beach.
What would you say is maybe one of your favorite memories about Portland when you first came here?
The thing I remember about Portland when I came, what I liked most about it was misting rain.
Misting rain.
Yeah, it wasn't a hard rain, but it was just kind of mist all the time.
You didn't have that kind of weather where you were born.
No. Where I came from, it was hot, and not too much rain, and cold, all the time. Yeah. But Portland, there was no misty rain, and then the beauty of the city. That's one thing that I really like too. It's just the greenery and so forth. That's I hadn't seen all that before, so it really was intriguing to me.
And what about you?
Well, one of the things that I think is memorable, after we got married and moved into our neighborhood, like you said, there were just two black families, our neighbor and then us, back in 1959. What I liked about the neighborhood, though, was that it was mostly populated by Scandinavians, Norwegian people, and Mississippi then had little neighborhood stores that catered to the kind of food they liked. And they would just kind of sit on the corner in the benches and kind of talk, you know, little old men, little old ladies. And they were very nice people, and they had names like Sarka, Carlson, and, you know, we got to know them.
Rinnakainen.
Yeah, just a really nice environment, you know, when we moved in. And a lot of those people stayed until, I guess, they got too old to stay in their homes. It was very nice. She overlooked some things, but it was a very nice environment.
What do you think was one of the most stressful experiences living in this neighborhood?
Well, I think that when we first moved there, you know, we were only one of two of the black families, and some of the neighbors that were, you know, lived around there, they some of them didn't want their children to speak to us and so forth like that. But we kind of got through that. The children had more sense than some of the parents, you know. But eventually that worked out, and some of the neighbors became, you know, great friends of ours. We're in touch with some of the kids now. Some of the neighbors, I've done weddings for them, and also I've done funerals for them. So
some of the people that didn't want to speak to us when we came in there, they are just, you know, tight right now.
Yeah.
Some of them passed on.
Do you have children?
Yes.
We have four boys.
We have eight children. We have four sons and four daughters, and they're all adults.
16 grandchildren.
Two great-grandchildren.
Two great-grandchildren.
Yeah.
And did you raise your children in Portland?
Right on Michigan, North Michigan.
Yeah. I wasn't around until 1990.
Oh, my 1990? Lord.
Wow.
Yeah,
you missed a lot.
Do you think it was a good neighborhood to raise kids?
Well, we'd say we moved there in 1959, and then about 1970, the neighborhood took quite a drastic change. It became quite a drug trafficking area.
But here, there was the Black Power and the Black Panthers were big, and, you know, there was a lot of violence in the streets, I guess, because people were angry about
burning things. About things. Back in the 67s, quite a burning over Martin Luther King.
Yeah, then the stores got closed up and boarded up, and nobody wanted to be around.
You are listening to Circle A Radio. That was John and Vivian Parker, and this is Kenny Poirier, one of the elders who participated in the Boise Voices Oral History Project.
My name is Kenny Lee Poirier. I was born in Cat Island, Bahamas, 1942.
What exactly brought you to Portland?
I was a drummer in Vancouver, B.C. I got to Canada because I didn't want to re-enlist to an army. When I first came up here in 67, so I was a lieutenant in the Nation of Islam. Had a place over in Mississippi and Shaper. That was a popular thing to be. And what made it so popular? They made you read. They had lessons. You know, I mean, you had to have your bow tie, your three-piece suit. And you remember the respect that we had back then when you saw us coming, everybody stepped off the sidewalk. You know, I'm 60-something years old, so racism back then was skyrocketing. You see what I'm saying? And I hate to say this, but nobody white couldn't say nothing to me. Absolutely nothing. When Martin Luther King got killed, I was working at a restaurant as a busboy. And the man I was working for felt so sorry, he gave us all the chance to sit down and eat. The waitress had to go in the kitchen and bring the food out to you. And the waitress said, "I can't serve him, my husband will kill me." You see what I'm saying? And I made up my mind then and there. You know, here's this person come to work every day with a little puppy and kissed his puppy and see me and lock the car door. I made up my mind. I just, you know what I mean? It took a long time. It took a real long time for me to even speak, you know. 1976, 77, there wouldn't have been allowed to come in my house, period. I mean, you know what I mean? So I've grown from that, so.
Grandfather, he was also someone that everyone had on the list. Grandfather's Corner Store, where Por Que No is now. And it was a really neat story of how he got connected with Brian Steelman at Por Que No. And Brian Steelman was really helpful, too. He brought in a whole stack of newspaper clippings and old photographs and documents that Grandfather had kept and then given to him. And so we had those to read through with the kids before we actually sat down and interviewed him.
Can you please tell me your full name?
Leonard Webb Smith.
Where were you born?
A sawmill town called Redenburg, Alabama, 1937.
Did you ever live in the Boise neighborhood?
I didn't. When I came to Oregon, I lived in Tigard. From 1976 until 1985 is when my wife and I got a divorce. So she said that, "Well, I'm going to go to California. What are you going to do?" I said, well, maybe I'm going to go to Portland and take my money and buy a building. She said, what are you going to do with the building? I said, I'm going to buy a building that I can have a house in and a bar. I'm a barman. So I bought the building on the corner here. The Nail building. When I came here, this street, every building on the street but this one. And it was a bar down there where the flower shop is. That was a bar. And on the corner where Betty Campbell building, that was the stripper bars and the grocery store. And the coffee house on the other side was a tax office and the drugstore. And I bought the building across the street. And that's when everything hit the fan. Because it was like 200 people all the time on the street. So I'm saying, oh, wow, good place for a restaurant, you know. And then when I come to find out, they were not the best people in the world. But I came here, that was 1985.
So you chose the Mississippi Street because you thought you were going to have a lot of business, right?
Yes.
But what was the consequence that you weren't planning?
Nothing I planned happened. Okay, because first thing, the liquor commissioner refused me a liquor license because of the element on the street. At the time, my argument was with the mayor that the police is not doing their job. See, every day the corner was full of people. They were selling drugs. They were prostituting. Whatever was going on, bad was here. These are dentures because a man knocked my teeth out. Police wouldn't come. So then the old Alabama in me came up. I got mad. And I said, I went downtown. I went to City Hall. And I had a sign on my back saying, they sell drugs in front of my place. Why not here? So Bud Clark wouldn't talk to me. And every morning, I was in front of City Hall. You know, I didn't have a permit. So I know what I got to do now. I got to go in here and make friends with somebody. So I went inside. You know, in City Hall, they got these little chairs for the visitors to sit, so I sit there. And I tell his bodyguard, I say, now, you know I'm harmless. So don't kill me or do bad things to me. So he said, no, you okay. So we became good friends. So I was there every morning. So Bud Clark one day, the kid got shot. So then they had a meeting. This meeting and all this is no good. I'm saying, sir, you got 10 days to do something about this. If not, I'm going to go to Salem and ask the National Guards to come. He didn't know I was that smart. So sure enough, 10 days came. I went down to Salem, and they brought the National Guards to Portland to stop the situation. Then Bud Clark talked to me. So finally, we became good friends. He gave me two police officers. And I gave them keys to my building. Then NBC got involved, and they would film the drug dealers and the prostitution out of the window. And then they had the police around, and they just come and sweep them up. So then they all knew that I was doing this, and that's when they broke out every window right there in my building. They just took a stick and broke all the other windows. So I'm saying, that's fine. We'll put some more windows in. Then a kid got killed in the wash house. A laundromat on the corner. And that was the first time anybody came to my rescue, and was the Kellys, Neil Kelly. They owned the building diagonal across the street from the laundromat. So they got, it used to be the Rejuvenation House. So then they got involved. And that's when we began to get some things going, because the older gentleman, Mr. Kelly, was on the city council. And every morning on his way to city council meet, he and I would stop, we would sit on the corner of Mississippi and Shaver. And I would tell him what we need to do downtown. And that's when they flooded the neighborhood with the police and kind of got things under control.
Why did you stay on the street?
Because I knew it could be something. Last year at the street fair, I looked down that street and I saw the street packed. Must have been 10,000 people on the street. They couldn't have come here without me. You wouldn't come on the avenue.
How do you feel about the changes in this neighborhood?
I really like the changes, and I don't, because I remember when there was gunfire every night. You could hear gunfire every night. And since the neighborhood has changed, you don't hear the gunfire. But you don't look and see the person at the grocery store that you used to see. Because now they might live 182nd and Burnside, you know, because they can't afford the rent in the neighborhood. But I didn't like the gunfire. But I do like the fact that Martin Luther King, if you look at that street, I've been all over the country, and every time I go someplace, I look at Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. And we have the most progressive Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in the country. I mean, I've probably visited 25 or 30 of them. And this one here is on the ball. And I was on that advisory committee for 20 years to advise what we wanted on Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard and how we wanted to structure it. Pretty much it's done what we wanted to do.
Do you have any advice for people my age, teenagers?
My advice, you'd rather get a habit. Early in the morning, before you have all the negative stuff, in the atmosphere, get you a book. Make a book your best friend. And the other thing, brother, don't let nobody make you quit nothing. First thing, quitter never win. He never win. One thing for sure, if you don't know much, you can't do much. That's been a truth since the beginning.
Is there anything else you would like to add that I haven't asked that you would want us to know?
No, I just want you guys to know that you need to get involved. It's sad. I just saw a young lady the other day. 20-some years now, she's doing the same thing. Still, I'm talking about walking through the neighborhood. They are prostituting. I gave her a big hug. I don't hate her because she's that way, you know what I mean? But you wouldn't know who she is, but but I do, see? So that's what's happening to our neighborhood, see? That these people, they're part of it. They live here, so I don't believe in the exclusion law. I was part of that, but I don't believe in it. And I think that people ought to be able to come home, but they got to behave according to the rules. We have to do it. So I don't know the answers to all the things that, happened, but there are answers. And I think that you young folks need to stand up and rally everybody. When you see in these things, when you see it, tell it. Tell it. Don't be afraid. That's what happened to me. See, had I listened to the kids, the guys here on this avenue, I would have been just like them, selling drugs. I would have been the same as them, but I never would do that. See, it's your future.
The interviews themselves were absolutely wonderful. I think one of my favorite parts was just seeing the kids and the elders, watching their connection with each other. Unfortunately, that was the kind of thing that, in order for us to get a good interview, it could just be a few people sitting around a table. So we weren't able to share that with as many kids as we would have liked to. But the benefit of having it put together on a website is that then it can be shared, and that these conversations, we can almost eavesdrop on them and benefit from in that way. And so the website, www.boisevoices.com, it's going to have pictures of all the elders that we interviewed, of the kids as well, and you can click on each of their faces and hear them ask a question and imagine what you would say in response to that question. And what we've talked about doing in the fall is with the third grade classroom at Boise Elliott Elementary School is having the kids in the classroom do an in-depth study using one of the stories from one of the elders. Just talk about the history that it raises. Talk about Vanport and the floods there. Talk about dance halls of Portland. Talk about segregation and redlining and how that affected the neighborhood. There's plenty of issues that are raised by these stories. And so to have the kids interact with it in a more meaningful way, and that the stories are preserved so kids, not only in the little third grade in our local school, but across the city or in other cities across the U.S., could use this as a teaching tool and interact with these stories. We have a CD as well, kind of trying to tell the story of this neighborhood. So we'll have a table at the Mississippi Street Fair and with some of the kids there, and Aaron and I, and stop by and say hi to us. And share your stories if you have any.
Again, the website for this project is www.boisevoices.com. Thanks to Apricot Irving, to the elders involved in the project, and to Kennedy, Janaya, Noah, Kane, Nyla, Dominique, and Melissa from Boise Elementary, and to Kyla, Sandra, Sherman, Darren, William, Sean, Sam, and Shaylin from Albina Youth Opportunity School for conducting the interviews we heard tonight. Circle A Radio is heard on the first and third Wednesdays of each month here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. You can contact us at circlearadio@gmail.com or through our website, www.kboo.fm/circlearadio. We also have past shows archived on the site. Our next show will air July 15th at 6 p.m. Thanks for listening.